Warning. RPG X-ray reality shields are at 17% and falling. Complete reality decay in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to RPG X-Ray, the podcast that looks inside what makes RPGs tick. If you are a role-playing gamer that wants to think about the hidden systems inside the games we love to play, join us for a regular discussion of the theory and practice of tabletop roleplay. This episode's topic is rulings. The use of at-table decision-making is one of the defining features of tabletop role-playing games that allows for unlimited player creativity. Relying on other humans, though, can leave your table open to bad behavior and interpersonal conflict. Join us as we discuss the differences between rules and rulings in RPGs. As a reminder, before we get rolling, please stay in touch with us and send in your own thoughts and questions. We're reachable via links on our website, rpgxray.com, or via our email, contacts@rpgxray.com. Joining the X-Ray team today are Jason Beaumont.
Hey, everyone.
Eric Saltwell.
Hello.
And myself, Ethan Schoonover. As always, before jumping into the main course, we like to start things off with an amuse-bouche we call Appendix X.
So in Appendix X, we do a little summary of all the media we're consuming currently, with a particular eye towards how it could be applied to gaming. For me, what I've been into for the last couple weeks is I have finally spent a bunch of time, effort, and now, I guess, money to get a upgrade my home theater system and my home office, a place to listen to my records and listen to music. So I guess I've been consuming like just a lot more media just in general, just as I kind of enjoy that. And part of like that whole process, if you're somebody like me, is you start reading tons of forums and tons of like guides on like, okay, here's how to like listen to see if your speakers handle like attack or decay correctly and all this other stuff, and which kind of bops you around to different songs or different movies. And during all that, you're kind of like isolating or attempting to isolate like a really specific part of what you're experiencing. Like, you know, you're playing a piece of music and you're just trying to hear the hi-hat or, you know, on a drum, or you're trying to just hear how like the violin kind of comes in and out. And the descriptive language that all of these use are a little bit like laughable. There's like a little bit of like this like kind of crazy audiophile language that gets used. But what I've learned just kind of by experiencing it and just like reflexively listening is I think it's expanding my vocabulary for talking about senses and like what you hear and what you're seeing, which is something I've always been a little bit weak on in the tabletop experience. As a GM, I'll try to describe a scene, but it's a lot of like analogy or a lot of, oh, you know, like in this other thing. And I felt like my descriptive kind of just vocabulary wasn't as rich as I wish it was. It reminds me a bit of the really excellent volumes that Watsi put out for Curse of Strahd, where they actually dedicate an entire section in both like, you know, the adventure and then in their Ravenloft settings thing to just like words, just like, you know, here's phrases that evoke certain kind of senses. And so that's been my Appendix X for me, is a lot of different media. And then that has been expanding my vocabulary for senses.
That is so neat, Jason. And that reminds me of when I was running the big D&D club in the girls' middle school. One of the exercises I used to do was to give the girls these like printouts of like old like Larry Elmore pictures. Wait, was it Larry Elmore? It's Larry Elmore, right?
Yeah.
Half the time I want to say Larry Elmore, I say Elmore Leonard, I'm sure.
Yeah, me too.
The old Larry Elmore photo, like pictures, paintings, covers, and I would give them these pictures and then have them sort of describe like what's going on. And first, you know, we might do, okay, I want you to describe all the action in the scene. I want you to, and then we would do things like, I want you to describe the colors and the textures. And then we would like really push them and be like, okay, what are the smells? You know, like things that you don't often. And I had a little worksheet. It was called the Five Senses worksheet that would push them to do that with like all the senses that they could. And
what a great idea.
It was awesome. I honestly think it was one of the best like DM prep things I did with them, just because it sort of got them into the idea of like, oh, you have to convey all this world that's in your head.
Right.
Because almost all like, all the DMs that I worked with, the student DMs, they had like this incredible vivid imagination, but it was so often like just sitting there in their head, and they were like, well, can't you see it too?
Right.
Which then I realized, I'm like, I do this all the time.
I do this all the time. Yeah. I mean, I think we've all been in this experience where we're trying our best to describe like a tense situation or a battle or something that's happening. And finally, a player will just like be like, could you just draw like where everybody is and what's going on right now? You know, and
right.
There was a big kind of, you know, climax scene in one of the games we were all playing together where everybody was battling these cultists out back of like this old English manor, and they were doing this ritual around this giant stone kind of object. And I felt like I had really done a good job laying out like, okay, there's like this line of trees around it. There's this clearing. At the center of the clearing is this stone pedestal that there's all these cultists. And as we began playing and everyone would describe what their characters were doing, I was like, what? Like, that's not where any of your characters are. What are you guys talking about? And I realized how I had failed to really get what was in my brain out onto the table well enough.
Well, you're also fighting against a weird anchoring problem, which is sort of the blind man and the elephant problem, where as you're describing it, even though I think you actually are, I think you totally filled in that scene. I'm remembering that.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody's sort of like fixated on the one thing most relevant to their character.
Oh, good point.
And and I feel like it sort of like skewed what, you know, one guy was feeling the tree trunk and one guy was feeling the rope or whatever.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, that is fascinating. Very cool. Let's do a whole episode on the senses.
How about you, Eric? What have you been listening to or playing or paying attention to lately?
So I've been watching Loki with my son, and it's one of our last ditch attempts to continue to partake of the Marvel milieu. And it was amazing and excellent. And the reason that I think it pulls back into gaming is that the end of it, which I thought was as good of an ending of a large multi-season piece of IP as I've seen, is that it really embodied what we've talked about in a previous episode about having kind of different modes of play as you increase in level and you go from like street level superheroes to city level superheroes to world level superheroes. And Loki did that very well, where it upped its game in season two and was able to really pull off expanding the scope of the story in a way that really felt like players going up in level.
That's cool. I like awesome. That a lot. Yeah. I haven't watched it yet, so.
Yeah,
it's season one. You haven't seen season one either.
No, I have. I'm behind on like all things TV, unfortunately. Yeah.
So for me, let's see, I guess two things are happening. One is doing a lot of amateur radio work lately. You know, amateur radio is a funny hobby. It's my secondary hobby, I guess, outside of RPGs. And it follows the solar cycle. So as the sun in, you know, what we call space weather changes over the course of a, you know, multi-year solar cycle, we either have better or worse propagation of ham radio signals around the world, and we're in sort of a peak right now. And so, you know, you can get on the air. I can get on the air with my little tiny radio sitting on my desk that spits out 5 watts of power, like less than a standard kind of LED light bulb in your house. And I can talk to, you know, Russia and Japan and things like this. And what I've been thinking about as I've been doing that is we have all these different modes that we use on ham radio. So we have like these hyper-structured modes. And then we have also these very loose modes. So like a hyper-structured mode might just be like me exchanging exactly the same, like, you know, call sign and then waiting for somebody else's name and then waiting for them to sort of give me a signal report and then wrapping it up. And there are so many funny game-like qualities, and so many aspects of the ham radio hobby have been gamified. This is not a new phenomenon. This is something that stretches back to the earliest days of the hobby. But I've been thinking about how there are the loose play aspects and then the structured play aspects. This actually kind of relates to rules and rulings, because what gets approved as sort of a recognized contact in the hobby is really like up to both players, so to speak, kind of coming to a consensus that they've had a successful contact. And that can be determined by the rules of the game in interesting ways. But then the other thing that I've been doing outside of that hobby has been reading a couple of books. I've been digging through Funk and Wagnall's Standard Dictionary of Folklore, which is a gigantic 2-volume set.
Nice.
And I brought it with me here. It's huge.
Wow.
Yeah. So I picked that up on a Powell's trip years ago. And there are a few things that I enjoy more than reading the dictionary. No joke. Just paging through looking for words that I might not know. And one of the other, this has that same joy for me, just like looking at all the definitions and terms and ideas that they decided to include in this folklore dictionary is just amazing. So, and I really recommend it if you're in, like, I think for DMs and role-playing gamers, game masters, people designing games, it is just an invaluable resource.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. So let me ask, I know that in back to the ham radio thing for a second, yeah. My understanding is that there are channels out there that are just people reading, like this is like a Russian radio thing.
Oh, there are number signal stuff.
Yes, yeah. The number stations. Yeah. So yeah. You can tune into that kind of stuff for sure. There are very famous number stations. That's a little bit outside. I mean, it's outside of ham radio in the sense that those are broadcast stations, which is illegal.
Oh, okay.
And if they're operating on ham bands, it's illegal. And they're not all, some of them do encroach on ham bands, and there's always weird interference, and there is a lot of weird geopolitics that kind of encroaches on that hobby for sure.
Yeah. I've definitely been trying to find ways in my life to add that to games, is the use of those channels. And
yeah. It would also be very fun to run a role-playing game over involving radio or technology somehow. I've often thought about doing this.
Oh, that's that would be super amazing. Super fascinating idea. Yeah. I always wondered, you know, when I see, you know, because we're on Discord together and stuff like that, and I see you, you know, like I went on this hike and, you know, I have my portable ham set up and I contacted Cambodia. I always wonder, like, what is it that you exchange? Do you exchange call signs, or do you say something about your lives? Like what does happen there?
So for me, if I'm really doing like real distant communications, it's almost always involving a digital mode, which is super structured. And it's what I do is I broadcast my name, effectively my call sign, which is Whiskey 7 Zulu Oscar Oscar. And that goes out over the air, digitally encoded, very roughly. And it's actually designed to survive just the absolute worst signal degradation that you can imagine. And because of that, and this is all, it's all math at the end of the day, right? Mm. It's phase encoded. So it's shifting the sine wave back and forth. And the receiver on the other end picks it up. And then the rule of the game of this mode is that they are supposed to respond to me with their call sign and a signal report. Like, how faint was my signal? How strong? I then do the same. I do a final signal report. And then in order to complete the game, we have to say goodbye. Yeah. There's a little bit of a politeness step to it as well.
I like that. I like that part.
Yeah. And so once you both say goodbye, then or at least one of the parties says goodbye, then it's all wrapped up and you can log it and you have completed that contact in that country.
I feel like I would just be so desperate to know, like, who are you? What are you doing? Who do you think I am? You know, seems like such a fascinating part.
One of the great things is we now publish, you know, we all kind of publish, at least people who are very active do publish little biographies online at a common website. And so you can look up who this other person is quite often. And it is just fascinating. I mean, I've talked to guys who are just like in a shack in the jungle.
Incredible. And it's amazing.
It is amazing. It's also amazing they're on the air at all. So it's a wonderful hobby. I really encourage. I feel like there's a good overlap with kind of nerdy role-playing gamers.
Of course. I'm totally with you. Yeah.
All right. So let's get into the meat of the episode today. Today's episode is rules and rulings. So a ruling is actually, let me take a step back. A rule is something that is a mechanical part of your system. It is often pulled from the text that defines the game system that you're playing. So if you're playing a fifth edition game, then rolling a d20 trying to roll over a difficulty class, that would be an example of a rule. Or how your characters level up could be a rule. In Apocalypse World, the defined list of moves are all rules. In contrast, rulings are intended to use just human judgment as a replacement, and is what really creates one of the defining characteristics of role-playing games, which is that you can do anything. What I'm seeing actually show up more and more in the industry called tactical infinity, the fact that you could just do anything. It's what really makes tabletop role-playing different and unique compared to, say, a computer role-playing game. And Ethan, I think you were the one that we were talking over Discord months and months ago, and you had said, oh, yeah, well, that's because, you know, you were referencing a philosophy of rulings over rules, which is that rulings are the things that should be primary and have authority over rules. And I thought that was really interesting and really, really, for me, encapsulated a lot of what the game means. And so I think our discussion today is about, hey, rulings, how do they get used? What are some of the problems that happen in using when you use it? And then what are some of the benefits? Could you have a game that was just rulings? And if so, what would be the cost of doing that? Like, what would you lose? And so here we are. Thoughts, folks?
Go on, Ethan.
No, I was waiting for you, Jason. I feel like this is just right up your alley.
It is a little bit up my alley. I would say that the balance between rulings and rules are what makes your table kind of almost the most unique thing. Right. And, you know, I think that you're almost more than everything we discussed earlier in Appendix X about ways that you talk at the table, your ability, a GM specific kind of ability to have, you know, their needle on kind of one side of rulings or on rules, or their flexibility or inflexibility and how they think about those things, I think determines the character of the table at play. Almost more than anything. It's my guess. It's just my hunch when I think about what you just said, Eric.
So can you give us an example of a type of a place where you tend to rely on rulings over rules? I think that'll be good to give people an example of a ruling, but also I think help inform kind of where are rulings really valuable.
Yeah, I would actually say the place where I end up more in the rulings camp than rules is actually in combat.
Okay.
Because I think we often get into situations where when we're in a combat scene in a game, if the GM starts from a, you know, the player describes an action and then you're immediately kind of decomposing that into like some certain rules for them, I think oftentimes they try to hunt for what those rules are a little bit to figure out what their moves are, you know, in a sense.
Yeah.
And so I will oftentimes, even when I know I could probably get down to brass tacks on a rule here, I'll use movement in combat as an example, right? I think, you know, when you learn like somebody can move 25 feet a turn versus 30 feet a turn, I almost never think of that in play. I just think of like one character is kind of speedy. And if like the move that they're trying to pull off expresses that speediness, my ruling often is like, okay, that sounds reasonable. You know, your difficulty level is going to be this, right? And so I think that's where I often end up in that interplay, where even when I know the system has some mechanics in place for me and I could do the work to present some rules at the table, I often find myself, depending on the players I'm playing with, wanting to go more in the ruling category. And then I'll pull out the rules here and there, like, okay, what you're describing is this kind of thing that the system has. And then I'll use that as a way to illustrate like the way the system works. Is that what you were looking for, Eric, as an example?
Yeah. What is for you there? What is the benefit principally that about play efficiency, that you don't have to go back to the rule system and that slow down your game?
If there's definitely that part, I think that's a benefit. But to me, it's more about encouraging expressiveness at the table.
Yeah,
because especially I think we often, the three of us, end up playing with people that don't have the level of system mastery that we have.
Sure.
I mean, they're not on like making a podcast about how RPGs work. You know, they're more than happy to come once a week or two and play with us and explore the worlds that we're creating. And so, you know, for them, they don't know how promotion points work in the Blade Runner game.
Right.
You know, and so I often will, you know, gently bring in, okay, there's this mechanic. But if I think it's going to hamper their expressiveness, or if I see them kind of flipping through the rule book in between times when their character is highlighted,
yep,
that's often when I try to like more foreground the rulings versus the rules.
So I just want to mention something that came to me while you were discussing that. And that I think about how in D&D we have so many rules.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
We have a plethora of rules. And we never apply all of them, right? When was the last time that you applied, I don't know, you know, like torches and light and things right, like this, right?
Right.
Yep.
And because it'd be like, you could say like, well, you know, if you don't have a light source, we used to kind of think about that. I mean, even in 5e, are there light source rules? I don't know.
I don't know.
But there used to be, and we would never apply them because it just wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes we would do it. It was a different kind of game, and it was fun.
Right.
Yeah. I think about the, we played with Jason. There was a hex crawl.
Oh, yeah.
In the ocean. Right. And so we landed on an island and there was a hex crawl. And all of a sudden, the rules about, oh, how much food do you have? And all of this all of a sudden became the game. I think what's really interesting about what you said, Ethan, is to me, is that rules set expectations about what is going to be fun in the game, right? It says, here's how you're going to play and what it's going to be about. And if I contrast, like talking very specifically about torches, there is a OSR or I don't know, there is a game called Five Torches Deep, which is very D&D-esque, but they have a interesting mechanic where torches last an hour of or whatever 20 minutes of play time, not of character time.
Oh, neat.
Yes. And there it is supposed to be. That is the point of the game. And the fun you're having is the tension that comes from being resource limited and resource limited in kind of a Red Markets-y kind of a way, which is a zombie apocalypse game that really doubles down on this concept of like, everything has a cost from resources and that's what the game is about versus like you're saying, Ethan, here in most 5e player, most actually role playing games, I don't want to track encumbrance. I don't want to track how long the torch lasts because that's not where the fun's supposed to be.
What's interesting about what you just said, Eric, to me is I wish I could run a hex crawl with all of the rules that a hex crawl provides while still having the evocative kind of description and a style of play that a more rulings heavy system does. And I think that if I was more experienced with hex crawls, I think that if I had, you know, things maybe better memorized or I was able to kind of like do things on the fly, I could have made the system more hidden from you. And when we were all doing that ocean exploration hex crawl, it would have felt as narrative as our other things, but just underpinned by some new rules. But because I was so new to hex crawls and I was just learning how to do them, I think I foregrounded the ruling so much. But to me, that became a really joyful part of our play. We were exploring kind of what it meant to play in this other style. But I bet if we'd spent a year doing it as a table, we would have learned the rules so much more innately that we would have become more expressive and evocative in our play versus, okay, who's doing the foraging today? Roll your foraging dice and then you're going to figure out how many fish you just caught, right? So,
okay, here's my pitch then. Mm-hmm. So in that scenario, you kind of had like the core hex crawl rules top of mind, but maybe not that deep bench of like, oh, here's the other like 300 rules about hex crawls that you can sort of like draw on to create that kind of evocative like rulings play. Now, I think there's two types of rulings that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. One is like I really liked the term that you used. It was almost a computational thinking term, right? Like that when you have a combat scenario and somebody describes what they want to do, what they want to achieve, or their general action, you then decompose it into specific rules that can be applied.
Right.
And because you have such a deep bench of knowledge in terms of what the possible rules that could be applied in any given scenario are, rather than apply all those like, you know, 20 rules, you know, movement, encumbrance, light, etc., you sort of pick and choose what also fits and matches the tone of play at that moment to create that evocative experience. And so there's rules where you're applying the rule very specifically and kind of formulaically. Then there's rulings where you are drawing on different rule components and kind of mixing them up into like, these are the rules that will apply in this scenario, which is a form of rulings. And then I think there's probably a third tier of rulings, which is like, rule of cool stuff and more like we're not really I'm applying my own judgment here. It's pure adjudication. It's not a specific rule other than adjudication.
Could you describe rule of cool, Ethan? Because I think that's a really rich vein to discuss.
I feel like I'm probably not the best person to do it, but I also feel like I apply it all the time, which is like the rule of cool is very, very simply like if, you know, given a scenario in any given game, the thing that feels the coolest should be the thing that you that happens that and then that it's OK. And not just the thing that feels coolest, it, like the thing that feels coolest is like doesn't mean like people get what they want, but there's sort of like the narrative payoff is highest.
So that's, yeah. And I feel like when I'm applying the rule of cool or something like the rule of cool, it's usually feels like that opposite case, right? Which is like the rule of tension, what creates a tense, exciting situation rather than like, I think what I see Jason do a lot and I really appreciate is highlighting a moment of awesome for a character and therefore for a player.
Yeah, I mean, I think that within the rule of cool spectrum, there's like rule of like totally rad. And then there's like the rule of narrative payoff.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's sort of that broad spectrum.
Yep.
So I want to just wrap up my thought before I turn things back over, though. And that is that I would say the most rule bound games are not the games with the most rules. The most rule bound games are the games with the fewest rules, because you feel more obligated to apply that rule or those rules.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you could actually make a case that D&D is one of the least rule-bound games out there, because especially if you know all the rules, you can do that kind of like middle tier that we're talking about, where you're like dynamically applying different rules, especially as a skilled GM, Jason, like as and which I think you really are, you know, when you're decomposing our intent into the rules that you want to apply. It is so satisfying as a player to have you say like, okay, this is what you want to do. Here's the rules that I'm going to apply to this scenario.
Yep.
And then we do our rolls and the probabilities take over. It's so satisfying because there's both like, I feel like you have it's like going to a custom tailor, right?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like the guy, he's like, oh, I'm going to take these measurements and I'm going to do all this. And this is going to fit this situation perfectly.
Mm.
Right? Okay. So what I just heard you say was that if you have a very universal rule system, one of the problems or challenges can be that because that rule always applies everywhere, it doesn't leave room or space for the GM to apply these kind of little mini rulings, right? Which are just custom in the moment rulings that make little very situation specific rules. Am I smelling what you're stepping in?
Yeah, I wasn't really thinking about universality so much, although that may apply here. I was just thinking that like if you have a rule system, like a one sheet or something like that, and it's got like two rules on it, you're always going to use those two rules.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah,
because that's all you have, right? That's your entire tool. Like this is, you know, Maslow, if every problem looks like a, you know, a nail, or if your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
I will say like that. Those two rules that have to matter a lot, right? And I'll use Dread as an example, which Eric has been running a Delta Green scenario via Dread with us for the last couple of weeks.
Do you want to summarize Dread for our listeners that don't know it?
Eric, why don't you summarize Dread since you're the master of it? Yeah.
Dread is a horror role-playing game where the core mechanic, rather than rolling dice, is that when you do something dangerous, you make a pull on a Jenga tower. And if the tower falls, then that is doom for your character.
And what I'm curious about, Eric, is that's the only rule of Dread, I think.
That's right.
When you think of applying that rule at play, I feel like it's a ruling when you decide to apply the rule.
It is very much so. That's right. Yes. Or like and in the same way that you might choose a difficulty class when you're using more of a D20 system, there's this, well, how hard or how dangerous do I think this thing is? And therefore, how many pulls of the Jenga tower do you need to make in order to be successful and not be doomed? Which I think is, again, another place where we as GMs, even inside of the rule system, the rules provide opportunities for rulings. I actually think that interaction between rulings and rules is some of the most interesting spaces in RPG design.
There's another kind of covert structure, I think, in any game system that we don't talk a lot about, although I think it is a topic of discussion. And that is that when you're doing rulings, every time, or when you're playing rules, every time that you do that, you're sort of like adding or subtracting to a reservoir of trust with your players.
Yeah.
And I don't think that you can success, like if you make rulings that are let's call them good rulings. Okay. Good. Yep. Whatever your definition is, right? Like sure. Successfully outcome. That's the whole point of this podcast, right?
Yep.
But that the outcome of the game is satisfying for everybody, even if like their player is dying, right? Which happens all the time in games that Eric runs. And that when you're doing that though, and you're creating these like successful outcomes, the player trust increases for the game master, and you can do riskier stuff, right? You can take bigger moves, I think, as a game master, if you've established a lot of trust with your players. And you can, and by bigger moves, I kind of mean like riskier, more dangerous, more like bigger narrative payoffs, more impactful, maybe even more negative because your players trust you.
Actually, so I have the most uncomfortable and least successful moment of my life in playing RPGs was I had played with three other players through my whole high school career, and we played multiple times a week, and we were all best friends, and we had so much of that, Ethan, so much of that trust. And I could really, and I was the perma GM, and I could really push us right to that line of, you know, this could be problematic and things are getting worse. And then I went to college, and my college hall, we played a game, and I ran D&D for them. We were playing Dark Sun, and I tried to do exactly that same thing. And because I didn't have all that trust built up, it was a complete disaster. We like ended in the middle of the we stopped playing because they thought I was being an oppositional GM who was just trying to screw them. And, you know, they started to like have secret meetings to talk about what they were going to do so that I couldn't. Yes, because they didn't want me hearing ahead of time and then being able to thwart them. And I feel like that trust and that that is clearly the challenge of rulings, I think, is that it does require that trust.
That is so interesting too, because so the, you know, the fact that they were having secret meetings because they didn't have that trust with you.
Right. Yep.
And like, that really reminds me of so much of like, I used to just sit in the college library where my mom worked, and like, I would read Dragon magazines. And I remember just being kind of flummoxed by like how much of the recounting of play felt very oppositional, because that wasn't how I played with my friends.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
And that there's the idea of, you know, like the game master trying to kill the players, and that was success for the game master. Like, that was definitely baked into a lot of early D&D play, and that kind of fell away, I think.
Yep.
And I think it's because we do have now like a kind of culture of trust between players and game masters.
Yep.
Where game masters even still exist, right? Mm-hmm. And we look at game masters more as like one of the players, just, you know, fulfilling a different role, that you kind of had that switch back to a different form of play. And I wonder if in that earlier form of play, it, you know, rules were so critical and it was so important to follow the rules, and players would often play rules as trump cards.
Yeah,
totally. Absolutely.
Right? Yep. Yeah.
Rules lawyering.
Yep.
Because they didn't have that foundation of trust. And so you did end up, you know, litigating whatever decision the game master made. And you would, oftentimes that would derail play for like an hour as you like litigated a rule.
And it doesn't happen anymore. It doesn't happen at all anymore. And I would say that back in the 80s, you know, it was really hard to find information about role-playing games. You would go down to your local Walden Books, or if you were lucky, a hobby shop, and you'd pick up something like a Dragon magazine or a supplement. Nobody had an actual play to go watch. Nobody had other tables even maybe that they ever participated in. And I'm sure, Ethan, you experienced something similar to me, which was the player that would show up with a Dragon magazine that they had purchased that had some rules that they wanted you to then follow, because they were like, oh, well, here's actually how the monk works or whatever. Right. I actually have psionic powers now. And you're like, wait, what? How does this, like, oh, I guess this is true because it's in the magazine, right? It was that back and forth, but because you were trying to figure out like what this game even was. you know, because there's just, there was nothing else like it.
That is so, yeah. You know, what I feel like is happening there is like, okay, so today we have this giant toolbox as a game master, especially as a game master of Dungeons and Dragons or any of these games that has these enormous sets of rules. You have an entire cabinet of curiosities of rules that you can reach into.
Right.
Whereas like in the past, we had a couple of slim volumes, didn't have any Google, couldn't look anything up, but players would then bring in a like subset of rules.
Yeah,
that definitely happened. It happened all the time.
Absolutely.
And it shifted gameplay sometimes like negatively and sometimes positively.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a different, like different people were reaching into different pockets for different sets of rules to present them at the table. And that is their own, that is that own kind of like dynamic rulings culture, but it turned inside out, right? Where the players are trying to do it as well.
Right. That's right.
Fascinating.
Mm. Yeah.
So I definitely love the aspect of rulings that it creates this opportunity that you were saying, Jason, about being able to do anything. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That it creates that tactical infinity, and it just seems to work. I remember I had a situation where this was in my 5e campaign. There was a flying monster and the player was like, they were in a canyon and they were stuck up against the wall of the canyon on a switchback. And the player's like, I'm just going to jump and try to land on top of the flying creature, which is something that like is, you know, in a computer role playing game, you would have to prepare for, and the developers had to have expected it would happen. And in return, we could say, you know, what I said to him is I said, oh, wonderful, great. That's going to be super effective. But if you fail, then you miss the creature and you splat. Right. And
right.
it is like really a great way. Like, I love it. And I think as I've progressed as a GM, my reliance on rulings, I think, just grows and grows. What do you guys think would be beyond the fact that there's this problematic play that you talked about? And I think that's really interesting about how either early in my career, we had to rely a lot more on rules to avoid problematic play, or maybe even the whole culture had this, right? That maybe if it weren't for the 80s, we would all have rule systems that relied much more on rulings than we have. My question to you guys is, what if we had a system that was just rulings? What do you think we would lose?
I think, okay.
Go up, please, Ethan. Yeah.
If we had a system that was just rulings, let's do an imaginary world where D&D doesn't evolve.
Yep.
And somehow, you know, born out of the head of Zeus, you have this game system, which is just completely like rulings based, and it's a new thing. It's role playing.
Yep.
I don't think it takes off.
And why not? I agree with you. What do you think is the, what have I lost?
I think that you lose. I think there is an implicit culture of role playing that we transmit. First, we had to evolve it, and it's been evolving since wargaming.
Yep.
But I think that it is transmitted, prior to the internet, it was player to player or book to player. And you sort of like tried to figure out like what it might be. I mean, I don't want to understate how important the first time you ever saw like a TSR television ad or something like that. Like, you know, seeing this cool game, this hobby presented in a television ad, that was canon.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. That was cultural canon. Like, I was like, oh, wait, look at how they're all sitting around like that. Look at that one guy in that ad had a, you know, interesting like piece of paper in front of him. I don't know what that sheet was, but I better figure that out because it looks like that's maybe part of the game too. And maybe I'm not doing it right. Like, we had to figure out how to transmit and create that culture. And then it got transmitted from person to person. That all was implicit role-playing game culture. And we still carry that with us today. And we carry that from game to game. And there are certain, and part of that is how we have established trust. And if you had a game that was just all rulings and it just landed on this alien planet, then you don't have that culture. And I think it would be a bad time for a lot of people until it would take a long time to create that culture again.
Yep.
I don't know. I guess I'm just, what I'm advocating for is like, I think that there is an implicit level of culture that you have to bring to any sort of gameplay, specifically role-playing gameplay, for it to be successful between humans.
I'm going to push on that for a second. I have a secret theory that the role-playing game I just described is the most popular role-playing game on Earth, but it is only played between, its target audience is 4 to 8 year olds. That it is make-believe, right? And and I actually totally agree with you, Ethan, that there is an important thing that gets added on top, that it is, it structures this play and it creates this defined culture and it helps you understand what am I trying to do when I'm playing. It'll, you know, I think a game is, again, is play where you're trying to overcome unnecessary obstacles. And that's not me. That's coming. I forget who came up with that definition. But in that world where it's just rulings, where you're playing make-believe, I think the problem is that you don't have those. You don't feel so much like there are those obstacles that to overcome. Okay. You are. Yep.
Yeah. This is, let's, I think we need to get Jason's feedback on this because, you know, as we all have kids. And as you raise your children, some part of your brain suppresses the early pain of the struggles of those early years. You think back only to the glorious moments. But I wonder, Jason, your kids are a little bit younger than the rest of us. Mm-hmm. So I absolutely agree with you, Eric. That's the 4 to 8 year old kind of play zone. I seem to remember that as I grew older, we started to do more like cartoon play or comic book play.
Yep.
So like, you know, you hit like 7, 8, 9. And I feel like a lot of it was thematic around stories that we had seen or read.
Yep.
And I feel like what's happening there is that's the natural, you're naturally gravitating. And this goes back to our IP episode, but you're naturally gravitating towards a world or rule system of some sort. There are some constraints. And if you are drawing from a shared play environment or like a shared narrative environment of some sort, you're sort of implicitly adopting some rule set.
That's really interesting. I agree.
But Jason, did you, I mean, since your kids are a little bit younger, I feel like you're a little bit more in touch with that evolution.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head that it's an evolution. I think there's definitely a developmental stage where everything is rulings based, to Eric's point. And then it becomes a little bit more rules based. And that's not just in their play, that's in their lives. Right. Like, I think that just as how we parent them, I think, you know, the three of us as kind of modern progressive parents, I think probably weren't very rules heavy, but we're more rulings heavy when we were kind of raising our kids. And now that my kids are getting to the age where they're starting to enter middle school, there's rules. You know, there's now things where, you know, I'll give an example. It's going on in my life right now, which is, you know, my daughter just started middle school and she sometimes wants to not go. She wants to stay home and have fun in the way that she did at grade school in her little like hippie grade school. Right. If you don't have a rule that says that you can't do that, if it's always a ruling, then it's a every morning, you know, the parental hell that you often get to where your kid is just kind of like lobbying you and debating you on like why the ruling should go their way. Right. And I think that's where you start to transition more into like, well, here are the rules. Here's, you know, kind of the responsibilities. Here are some of the consequences, because our own real life starts to have more of that. And I don't know if you're ready for that kind of play at the make-believe age, to Eric's point. But I do think that if our work lives were only rulings, or if video games were only rule, like it doesn't make sense. Like it doesn't like hold together. There's like a mechanical nature to these, you know, things. And that's when rules come in. And that helps us understand what is possible and what is harder and what is easier. And I think to Eric's point, I think Eric's thesis of RPGs is about overcoming obstacles. I think. And I think that if the obstacles are only rulings, that's just not as satisfying. It's a, did I correctly lobby Ethan? Did I correctly lobby Eric? Did I put on a big, did I throw a big enough tantrum that he finally gave up? Right.
Yep.
Whereas the rules actually create the obstacle of weight of meaning.
Right. It's almost like, should I be proud that I was successful?
Ah, yeah.
Right. Like, did I earn it? No way. And I think you're right. Or when I tie all of what you said together in my head, it makes me think that and I've read this is somewhere else, that the value of a rule system, not just rulings, is that it creates outcomes that no player at the table would want. And
interesting.
That's a great, I love that line. That's a fascinating line. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like that's probably true, right? That and I think there's also an element there of that's also what randomness and dice bring to the table as well, is not just bounce and variation, but creating outcomes that none of you would have wanted, but that at the end of the day, you're really happy happened.
I think that's why you're a very adept Delta Green GM, because I would characterize the style of play of Delta Green as one where you go from one shit show to another, right? And that's and by the way, it doesn't end in anything other than the worst shit show, right? Yeah. And I think that you need a GM that views rulings and rules and the balance between them as like, that's the play that I'm guiding. And Eric, everything you just said just kind of opened my eyes to why I enjoy playing those kinds of games with you.
Right.
And why, you know, when you say DM a D&D game, which is very much a power fantasy game, I've noticed you spend most of your time subverting the power fantasy.
Yes.
More than you do being like, yeah, you did it. You got the Sword of Gondor.
Yeah.
You're going to lop some heads off. You're like, no, too bad. The sword's cursed. And the head you're going to lop off is your best friend's, right? Like, that's like a very like Eric moment in a game, right? So I guess to me, that goes back to the ruling and rulings balance. A specific GM brings to the table is the flavor that they're creating for the table.
I just want to link this back to the issue of randomization of the world as well, because I'm not enamored of roguelike play, and by roguelike play I mean referencing the original Rogue video game where everything is a randomized world, and there are plenty of role-playing game scenarios like this where you roll dice to determine the dungeon and things like this, and I really need things to be kind of born out of somebody's mind.
Yep.
And not just that, to have been crafted and written down somehow. Like, I want to feel like I am, that it's tractable. I want to feel like the world is tractable, that there is a world for me to overcome and engage with. And I don't know why that's so important. I think it's a quirk of my psyche, but.
Oh no, I feel it too. I definitely feel it. And when I think about it, I think, but I think this is in the best possible way, that it feels almost like the best part of simulationism in role-playing game, which is that the role of simulation, which we should talk about as an episode, is that it makes that world feel real, and it makes it feel like that I am overcoming those challenges, and they are, you know, in some sense, real challenges that I can feel proud that I overcame.
Mm-hmm. All right. So here's my premise. Here's my pitch again, a new one. And that is that rulings, if it's just ruling, if it's just adjudication on the spur of the moment, like you try to do that, but here's what actually happens, or, you know, here's the result. Here's my adjudicated result. And that's just coming out of the mind of the GM. It's not fun. It has to be the rulings that are most enjoyable are the rulings, like you just presented as a scenario, Eric, where you said like, okay, you want to do that thing that's not in the rule set.
Right.
Here's my ruling, which is really kind of a dynamic mini rule.
Absolutely. Yep.
And that ties back to the way I think Jason really excels, which is like, I know 1,000 rules. I have 1,000 tiny screwdrivers in my tool chest. I'm going to present you with the 5 that are most applicable and that will be most like enjoyable in this scenario. And now you have to assemble the thing with those 5 tiny screwdrivers, right? Like, I'm presenting you with a set of tools when I'm presenting you with rules that apply to this scenario. And that's really, I would say, like, my proposal is all rulings are actually a presentation of a dynamic set of small rules.
That are kind of created in the moment as necessary, and then can choose to vaporize into thin air or not.
Right.
I love that. That's a really, that's a super useful way of thinking about it.
Okay, so I have an example, and my question to you guys is this a ruling? And if it isn't, what is it? We were playing Knights Black Agents, and there is a rule in Knights Black Agents called heat. And so this is, as you do things, if it attracts attention, that can cause badness. And I don't even think I was following the rules, but I think what we had done was the characters had come into a bar and they had done some stuff that had generated some heat. And I was going to do a roll, which would determine whether or not that heat was going to catch up with them. And were we going to have a scene where they had to flee as the police came, or as somebody came. And I don't remember if that's really what the Knights Black Agents rule is, but here's what I did, right? And it was just like in the moment, I was like, okay, I want to make this more tense, add a moment of tension. And we were playing in Jason's house and I asked him for a cup and we rolled the heat. But rather than exposing it right away, we left it under the cup until they were well enough into the scene and then we would reveal it, right? And so like that roll was sitting there the whole time. And the players could look at the cup and feel like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen, but it was already done. Is that a ruling? And if not, is it a rule? What is it?
It's a quantum rule, right? It's the, it's not a rule or a ruling yet, right? Yeah.
It's also, okay, this is blowing my mind.
Yeah.
Why don't we do this all the time, actually?
I totally agree with you. I mean, it was really successful.
I was going to say, I bet that, like, was a great moment at the table.
Yeah.
Wow. Boy, that's really got my gears turning. I don't think I've ever experienced something like that in a game where there's like a kind of a predetermined component that everybody commits to that is sort of random, but then revealed.
And I think what's interesting about it is that it's not really a part of any resolution system because it does not impact the result. Right. It is. Mm-hmm. It's window dressing. It is like an aesthetic component, not actually a mechanical component. But boy, does it have effect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, on that note, because I think that's something that I would definitely want to add to play. Why don't we bring it back a little bit? We had a wide ranging discussion about rules and rulings. Why don't we each talk about what we would bring back to our tables from our discussion today? Eric, why don't we start with you?
I really am intrigued by this thought of how simulationism is something that is a necessary precomponent for challenge and overcoming challenge. And I need to think of, because I'm actually somebody who I think likes under the covers to do some quantum orking in order to create tension. For those who are unaware, quantum ork is a commonly used phrase in the industry, which means if I've prepared a really great encounter with an orc and my players go somewhere else, they don't take the left path, they take the right path, just move the orc over. I'm willing to do that if I think it creates a greater tension. And I think what I need to reflect on is, what are the rules that tell me when I can do it? And it does build tension, but then when does it violate what Ethan's talking about, which is that I want to feel like I'm acting in a world that is real and is, has some kind of heteropenomenological truth to it.
Mm-hmm. Ethan?
I definitely am going to think more about this idea of rulings as dynamic mini rules, because I don't think I present them like that. And I don't think that, and I think my rulings kind of are weaker because of that. But I think if I am trying to give players a little bit more volition, a little bit more opportunity for choice between those scenarios, I think that's Eric's strength and I'm going to steal it.
I think for me, we got a little bit of a conversation about hex crawls and expressiveness and kind of the balance between rules and ruling when doing a hex crawl style campaign. And for me, over some time off coming up over the holidays and stuff, I'm hoping to read Justin Alexander's book. He's the person who does the RPG blog, the excellent RPG blog called The Alexandrian. He's got a book out called So You Want to Be a Games Master. And he's written quite extensively about hex crawls and point crawls and like how to run them. And so I'm hoping to kind of take some of the things we talked about today with some of the knowledge that I'm hoping that book gives me and learn how to be better balanced in that kind of play.
All
Okay, so that's it for this episode of RPG X-Ray. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us improve the show and reach more listeners who share our passion for role-playing games. As always, we hope this episode has given you some new insights and ideas for your own table. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, please reach out to us on our own website or social media channels available in the show notes and at rpgxray.com.
RPG X-Ray system shutting down. Prepare for full reboot next episode.